This is Writer's Voice. Today, two books on crime in America. First, as meaningful gun safety legislation is perpetually stalled in the U.S. Congress, another approach to preventing gun violence is gaining ground throughout the country. We talk with Mark Fullman about his book, Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. And later, we talk with Rachel Rear about her investigation into the murder of her stepsister and the government corruption that long delayed solving it. Her memoir is Catch the Sparrow, A Search for a Sister and the Truth of Her Murder. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. 10 years ago, Mark Fullman joined with other reporters at Mother Jones to establish a database of mass shootings in America. The rate and number of mass shootings has only increased from then, which led Fullman to the question, what can be done to prevent mass shootings in an environment where passing gun safety legislation on the national level seems out of reach? Fullman discovered a prevention movement gaining ground that uses assessment, treatment, and compassion instead of punishment to identify and prevent people at risk of becoming mass shooters. His book, Trigger Points, explores this approach in fascinating detail. Mark Fullman is a longtime journalist and editor who's worked with Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, and The Atlantic, among other press venues. Well, Mark Fullman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me. It's great to talk with you.
You were on the team at Mother Jones that built the database, A Guide to Mass Shootings in America. I remember when that appeared and how, you know, really shocking it was. Tell us a little bit about that project and how that led to this book.
Sure. It's a little bit remarkable to think that's now a decade ago that I began that project at Mother Jones. In July 2012, there was the terrible mass shooting at a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado. And at that point, I had been covering gun violence for a number of years, but became more intensely focused on this issue of mass shootings, some fundamental questions about it. Was this starting to happen more often? Who is actually doing this kind of attack? At the time, it may be a little bit hard to recall now, given how much this has happened since then. But at the time, that was really an unprecedented event and very shocking, that the idea that someone would walk into a movie theater and murder 12 people and injure scores more in an attack like that, and then just wait in the parking lot and be arrested. So I had a lot of questions, and I went looking for data on the problem, and I was startled to find that there was essentially nothing publicly available. So that was really what prompted me to gather some colleagues and begin building a database. And we produced the first open source version of this online and began to collect a lot of data on cases going back 30 years at the time. Now there are 40 years worth of cases in the database. And I began to analyze it and study it and do some further reporting and started to find some very stark patterns in the data, and also started to come to understand that there was really a lot about this problem that we were misunderstanding and that was being covered wrong in the media. There are, in fact, some big myths about the problem of mass shootings. And so that's what started to lead me to the book, that and the discovery of this prevention method known as behavioral threat assessment, learning more about that field, which is the focus of Trigger Points.
So this book really takes a different approach from the one that I would think is really the mainstream approach, was to try to pass gun control laws. And of course, that's been impossible because the gun industry has captured so many of our legislators, impossible at least to now. So talk about this approach of harm reduction and prevention, and then I'll ask you more in detail about behavioral threat assessment later.
Sure. I think, you know, many years ago, I came to the conclusion that there had to be other ways we could think about this problem. And you know, I think I, like many other people in our country, had grown somewhat frustrated with the sense that the political debate over gun regulations was really stuck. And, you know, there's some myths there too. The idea that nothing ever happens, that's not necessarily true either. It's true at the federal level. We never see progress from Congress. And that's what I think is the source of so much frustration from people on this problem. At the state and local level, there's been enormous change in gun regulations over the past decade, in the period in which I've really focused on this issue. The problem is that it's very patchwork. It goes in both directions politically. So we have states in the country that have created much tighter regulations around firearms. And then there are many places where they've grown even looser than before. So the national picture is still very stuck in this regard. And, you know, harm reduction and prevention work became a subject of much greater interest to me in realizing that it wasn't enough for me to be resigned to the problem in the way that I think in some ways we have become culturally. We've sort of accepted this idea that there isn't really anything we can do to solve this problem. And that didn't work for me either. I felt like there had to be other ways to come at this problem. It's a complex issue, gun violence. And there's a broad range of it too. You know, these public mass shootings that really became the focus of my reporting are only a small fraction of our gun violence problem, but it's a distinctive problem that has inordinate impact. And therefore, I think is what became an important focus.
Right. And it doesn't preclude the kinds of prescriptions that you have in this book, Trigger Points, Mark Fulman. Don't preclude dealing with other aspects of gun violence at all.
That's right. And I think, furthermore, that this prevention method of threat assessment has potentially much broader benefits, because it's really about trying to detect behavioral warning signs and indications that a person may be heading down this pathway, what's called in the field the pathway to violence, and intervening constructively before an attack like this occurs. And there are other benefits to that process, especially with early intervention, to helping people who are in crisis, who are deeply troubled, and who are developing violent ideation. That's the core of this work, what it seeks to both identify and evaluate, and then intervene and try to relieve, to steer a person away from that pathway.
Clarify for us the difference between profiling and behavioral threat assessment.
So this is another myth that we have about this problem. I think a lot of people believe that there's a way to profile predictively who a mass shooter may be, who's going to do this. And researchers have tried for a long time to develop a character profile that might indicate who would be dangerous in this way. And it's simply impossible, because none of the attributes that we see in these cases have predictive value. They're just far too broad-based. People often bring up the fact that the vast majority of mass shooters are male, but gender tells you nothing predictive about this problem, because of course, the vast majority of men, even men who are struggling with personal problems or mental health issues, or life circumstances that are difficult, would never dream of doing something like this. So gender in and of itself isn't predictive, nor is race, nor is interests culturally or interests in entertainment, violent video games, all of these things that we tend to see blamed as causal, as the reason that people commit attacks. There's just no scientific evidence to support any of that. So the distinction here is that what this field has sought to do through several decades of research is to develop a deeper understanding of the behavioral process that leads up to these attacks. And this is also another really important principle of both this problem and this field of work, and speaks to another big myth that we constantly repeat about this problem. The idea that they sort of just come out of nowhere, that these are people who are just snapping. That's a theme we hear after many of these high-profile attacks, right? The question, what made the guy snap? As if this was an impulsive act. But that's not true. That's not the case. In all of these cases, we're talking about planned acts of violence. These are people who are developing a violent idea over time and are developing it and planning it out and preparing for it and then deciding when to carry it out. And with that, you have a trail of behavioral warning signs that are often detectable, especially to people who are close to or around the would-be perpetrator.
So start at the beginning of a behavioral threat assessment. What are some of the early warning signs? How do they move from one stage to the next? Outline for us the progression of a behavioral threat.
Right. So it's really a holistic approach to taking in a lot of information around a person who is raising concern. And one of the things that I really tried to do with Trigger Points was to show this through narrative storytelling. I was able to gain access to a lot of cases of threat cases being worked by threat assessment teams and to see how they actually do this, how they evaluate the situation, and then over time work to intervene constructively and help the person who needs help. And so I did this in particular in a school setting. I write about this at length in the book. A team in Salem, Oregon, the Salem Kaiser School District, a large K through 12 public district that has a team of trained experts who do this work. And most of the cases that they are handling are sort of garden variety behavioral problems that you see in kids, in students. But within that, there's a small subset of cases that get more serious. And the way that these usually come to the attention of a team is beginning with a tip, with someone speaking out of concern, raising their hand and saying, I'm worried, whether that's a student, a peer, or a teacher, or an administrator, or sometimes a family member, noticing behavior in a case subject who that is causing anxiety or fear, and maybe not understanding what it is. But the team then brings the expertise that they have that is multidisciplinary. So you have mental health professionals involved in the school setting. You're talking about counselors, psychologists, administrators who are trained in the method of threat assessment. Also working together with law enforcement, with juvenile services, in some cases with county mental health practitioners, working together to try to essentially diagnose the situation and find out more about what's going on with the person of concern. So just to give one example, there's a case that I write about at length in the book of a kid named Brandon, which is not his real name, a high school junior who one day is overheard by peers saying that he's going to bring his dad's gun to school. He tells another student, don't come to school on Friday because I'm going to come back here and shoot up the school. One of the kids that overheard this grew worried about it and told a faculty member. And so then the team moved quickly to evaluate, is this a real threat? What's going on with this kid? What's going on with Brandon? And they do that by quickly gathering as much information as they can around Brandon. They're going and talking to his peers. They're talking to his teachers. They contact the family. They were able to determine quickly that Brandon did not, in fact, have access to a gun. He had told another kid that he had actually obtained the code to his father's gun safe. So that kind of very specific threat is concerning to a team. It's different than just sort of talking generally about school shootings, because it could indicate that a plan for violence is developing in a person's mind, that, you know, with these specific ideas about how he's going to carry it out, when he's going to carry it out. So that's a certain kind of warning sign to a trained team. But there's no one thing that indicates violence. It's a constellation of factors that they're looking at. What else is going on with this kid? Well, it turned out that he had quite a few problems. He was deteriorating personally in some ways. He was failing in a couple of classes. He dropped out of a drama club that he had previously been really engaged with and liked, and had talked about being really humiliated by an experience he had tripped on stage during a rehearsal. So the team grew very concerned. One of the counselors who was involved in the evaluation felt that there was significant concern that he was suicidal. There were some indirect but strong signs that he had acute low self-esteem, that he felt like he had no one to talk to about his problems. There were some issues in his home situation. So by gathering all this information, the behavioral threat assessment experts can then evaluate what is the level of concern here and what can we do specifically to try to help this kid who clearly is in crisis and is giving off these troubling signs in his comments about school shootings.
So this is really a compassionate approach, and very much in contrast to the kind of zero tolerance approaches that many school systems took after Columbine. How does this approach stack up against a zero-tolerance approach in terms of successfully being able to avert shootings?
In some sense, this field continued to develop as a response to what I think could be understood as the failure of zero-tolerance policies and that type of more harsh or punitive approach to aberrant behavior. This is something that the research had shown already for a number of years in a broader sense with workplace violence and other forms of targeted attacks that the field of threat assessment was seeking to understand better in order to thwart. And the research showed already quite clearly that when you take punitive steps to deal with somebody who is acting in troubling ways and maybe in crisis or maybe enraged or aggrieved, if you only do that, often it's ineffective and in some cases may actually increase the risk because it can serve as what's called a triggering event, one of the areas of warning behaviors that I detailed in the book. When you kick someone out of school or fire them from their job or serve them with a restraining order, there are many cases of attacks, of mass shootings going back decades where people in that situation come back and they're still dangerous and they may then attack the school or the employer, or they may go somewhere else and commit an attack. And so over the years, the experts have learned that it's better in many cases to intervene more constructively, to try to help the person and relieve them of their core root problems, right? What is the core grievance going on with this person? Because the reality with these cases, with many of them, is that the perpetrators are in a position where they feel like they have no other option, that violence is their only way out of their problems. And they've come to see that as a valid solution to their despair and rage. They may also have mental health issues going on. But contrary to popular belief, mental illness is not a primary cause in most of these cases. These are people who are mentally unhealthy. They're having a lot of problems, but they're not crazy in most cases. They're not psychotic or hallucinating. They're developing an idea about how to deal with their deep problems that is unhealthy, and in many cases are desperate for help. And so this is what this field of prevention work tries to do, is to address that. And by doing that more constructively, has actually found that it reduces contact with the criminal justice system, which was a big problem with the zero tolerance policies in schools. You just had a lot more kids being sent off to juvenile justice systems through that approach after Columbine.
You know, you mentioned before, Mark Fulman, about restraining orders, and that put me in mind of, is it true that domestic violence is also part of the path to violence of this that enters into behavioral threat assessment?
It's an important factor, and I think it's a growing one and increasingly understood within the field of threat assessment. And I found that in my own research that issues of domestic violence and misogyny can figure into and do figure into many cases. So you can see where restraining orders come into the context as well. And it's a challenging situation. These are complex situations. So again, the point I think here that's important is a restraining order may be very necessary. It may be an important step to take in some cases, and it is. But if that is the only step taken, it will prove in many cases to be insufficient. And there's a long history of that in the case research where troubled people who were, you know, engaged in stalking behavior, in harassment, who were served with restraining orders by, you know, intimate partners or spouses or ex-partners, then became more dangerous or then went on to commit an attack. It didn't stop that behavior. So the question for threat assessment experts long ago became, what else do we need to do here? And what can the research into cases tell us? And what they learned is that by taking a much broader based approach to evaluating a person's circumstances and thinking of more broadly about the set of tools that might come into play, both constructive and in some cases also punitive, or, you know, through the criminal justice process, that is necessary in some cases. But many of these perpetrators are people who are in need of help and are responsive to it. I think that's one of the surprising and hopeful things that, in terms of what I learned and write about in the book. It's very counterintuitive in some ways. When you think about the nature of this crime, it's so horrific. But what led a person to that point? There's so much that goes up to that, that speaks to the possibility to prevent it from happening.
And this is really at the heart of your book and Trigger Points. But it also begs some much larger questions. I used to be in the mental health field. I was a crisis intervention social worker. Among other things, I also worked with families who were involved with domestic violence and other issues.
Yeah, so you know this territory well.
Yeah, but it was a completely dysfunctional system, which is one of the reasons that I left. People don't have access to the kind of care that they need. We have a society that extols violence as a way to solve problems rather than dialogue and diplomacy. We have, obviously, the fact that guns are so readily available. These are so much bigger, and they really bear on the ability to spread programs like the behavioral threat assessment programs that you speak about in this book. How did you juggle this kind of conceptually in thinking about this problem?
Well, one way that I came to think about it as my thinking evolved was that I think there's something important about the kind of cultural and political frame that we put around the problem of mass shootings. And I think you're getting at it to some degree in your comments. And this also goes back to what I was saying earlier. I think we've developed this kind of resignation about it that in some ways validates it in a way that is unhelpful, to accept this idea that, you know, this problem will go on indefinitely and there isn't really anything we can do about it. And yes, it's complicated. There are big cultural forces at play here. The guns that we have in our society, the violent entertainment, a political landscape that has grown more volatile and more kind of fraught with extremist thinking, and that becoming more acceptable. This is a growing factor in threat assessment cases in recent years. All of this taken together can make it feel like, well, we want to just throw up our hands and we can feel angry and outraged and saddened by it, but also resigned to it. And I think that in and of itself is problematic for several reasons. One, it diminishes the possibility that this kind of prevention work, which I came to see as quite promising through the course of reporting for Trigger Points and looking at many cases where it seemed to be remarkably successful, it kind of detracts from that. It also, I think, in some sense can validate a violent act for someone who's thinking about committing it as a solution to their problem, especially people who are seeking attention for it. And that is a big component in many of these cases too, with perpetrators who are seeking sensational media attention. They want to be seen as sinister and powerful and evil, all of these kind of, you know, constructs that historically we put around this issue in our media narratives around it and in our political narratives. And I think there's a lot to be said for kind of demystifying the problem and saying, that's not who these people are. These are people who have a lot of problems and are desperately in need of help. So I think that the cultural perspective that we've become so accustomed to and the political deadlock that we've become so accustomed to should go away, or we can work more to make progress by setting that aside and you know, demystifying the problem and treating it less sensationally.
Yes. And, you know, it's funny because I was actually, when I asked my question, I was thinking about it in a different way, not in the sense of, you know, it's too big, let's just throw up our hands, but more in the sense of, could programs like this actually lead to larger discussions, lead to shifts in understanding the need to serve people's needs in this country better? Not just mental health needs, but also all the other kinds of incredible stressors that apply to a growing number of Americans.
I think so. I came to see quite a bit of promise in this work in that regard. And I have learned also in the course of my reporting and talking to pioneers of this method and leaders in this field, that a core part of their mission is to kind of reorient and raise cultural awareness. And that's primarily about better recognition of behavioral warning signs, and then also trying to create better community engagement, because that's crucial, as I was saying earlier, to many of these cases, how they begin. It requires an ordinary person to speak up and reach out for help. And they have to do that knowing that this exists, having trust in it, that it will be a quality process with good outcomes, and to know where to turn. So the bar to that is relatively high in terms of, I think, how this might be scaled into a bigger part of a national solution. But I agree with you that if that can take place, there is potentially a much broader range of benefits within school systems, within workplace cultures, and within our communities more broadly, ultimately, that we could have a better awareness of how to help people who really need it. I mean, that's the twin goal here of this work and why I became so interested in it. You're talking about heading off potential violence, planned violence as it's taking shape, while at the same time getting help to people who are desperately in need of help in many cases.
Exactly. It really does beg the question of a more social society-wide approach, as well as the focus on individuals. Well, this is a very thought-provoking book, Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. Mark Fulman, thank you so much for talking with us here about this really important problem.
It was my pleasure. Great to talk with you.
Mark Fulman. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Trigger Points. Next up, a story about true crime and official corruption. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Growing up, Rachel Rear knew the story of Stephanie Kopchinski's disappearance. The young woman was the daughter of Rear's high school music teacher. Then, several years after she vanished, her father married Rear's mother. Stephanie and Rachel Rear became stepsisters, posthumously. Rear's uncanny resemblance to Stephanie was just one of the points of contact that drove her curiosity and then obsession with finding out what happened to Stephanie. She chronicles her search in her gripping memoir, Catch the Sparrow. Rachel Rear, welcome to Writer's Voice. Catch a Sparrow, A Search for a Sister and the Truth of Her Murder. This was your stepsister, Stephanie, who disappeared at the end of July 1991. That was before her father married your mother, so although you had known of the disappearance, you never actually knew her. But you felt an uncanny connection to her. Why?
That's true. Jerry Kopchinski, her father, was my music teacher. I had been in summer orchestras with him, small groups. I played the clarinet and I sang. I was involved in almost every musical ensemble you could be in. So this was a man who had had an enormous impact on my life. I actually was a music major in college for one semester. So music was extremely integral to my life. And he was the man who had started the music department in our town. So he was a person that I knew, who I respected and cared about as an educator. And I was 14 when she vanished, and basically, all of his music students knew what had happened. Many of my friends who are my age remember everything crystal clear. And I just remember, you know, I think I've said this before, but 14 is kind of the perfect age to be riveted by a story like this, to be mystified by the sudden and unexplained disappearance of a young woman. Plus, I would see Jerry walking through the band room and, you know, as I would try to tell what he was feeling. And he was very stoic, a very stoic person. But to me, he looked sadder, perhaps more hunched over. His Parkinson's had taken a toll on him. And once Stephanie vanished, it intensified. So it was just always a thing that I cared about.
Other people see an uncanny resemblance to her in you. People said to you often, you look like your sister. I mean, they don't even say stepsister.
Yeah, I was always really clear to explain to everyone that I spoke to that Stephanie was my stepsister and that I had never met her, but that I was interested in finding out who she was, this family member who disappeared, who I never met. Maybe there's a kind of, you know, and I've spoken about this before, an idealizing of what she could have been to me, perhaps, which is, I think, kind of why the subtitle of my book is A Search for a Sister. But I did tell people she was my stepsister. I never met her, but people sort of projected what they, I don't know if it's what they wanted to see, but they projected it onto me that she was just my sister. Even asking me, her boyfriend, one of her ex-boyfriends from Martha's Vineyard, sat down to brunch with me and said, "Are you sure you're not related?" You know. And Jerry himself, when my mom married him, when he became my stepfather, he would tell me that my eyes were just like hers, that when he looked into my eyes, he felt like he was looking into her eyes. And as his Parkinson's developed into Parkinson's related dementia, he conflated us as though we were one person. He would confuse details about us and ascribe details about one of us to the other. For example, my birthday is Christmas Day. And on Christmas Day, my mom said, "Do you remember who has a Christmas birthday?" And he said, "Of course, Stephanie." So it wasn't just that he mixed us up. It was almost like we were one conjoined being in his mind, which felt otherworldly at times and reinforced my connection to her story, of course.
Now, tell us just a little bit about her. When you found out about who she was, when you spoke to people who knew her.
Sure. I really fell in love with her, you know, as a sister, as I was learning about her. When I would speak to people from her childhood or from her young adulthood, they told me hilarious stories. They laughed. They talked about how bubbly she was, how zany she was. And I felt a kinship to her. She did funny things, like, I don't know, a couple things. She made up a game where she would like make a blender of strawberry daiquiris for her string quartet in college. And then they would sight read a piece. And if you missed a note, you had to drink, you know. So like, she's just a funny person. She would curse in a Russian accent, like Boris and Natasha. And just things like that. They called themselves the Cursed Quartet because they were always like stringing together profanity when they messed up. Just funny things, really lighthearted things, but then also darker things, which also drew me to her because of similarities between her childhood and mine. It's not much of a spoiler to say, but I did, because I say it pretty early on in the book, but I did discover that my stepfather was not as gentle as I thought he was when I met him, and that he also had used physical violence in his home against Stephanie. And several of her high school friends really wanted me to know that and wanted me to include that. They felt strongly that this was the story of her whole entire life, you know, and that experience really did work its way into her psyche. I myself was also abused as a child by my father. So there's a connection there. You know, I developed an understanding for why she operated the way she did, why she moved through the world the way she did, perhaps why she found herself in the relationship she was in Martha's Vineyard, which was a highly volatile one involving physical violence as well and threats and things like that, which is why she eventually fled Martha's Vineyard and ended up in Greece, where she was murdered.
In Greece, New York, we should say.
In Greece, New York, yeah. And, it was interesting to have to sit with the idea that my stepfather, who to me felt like an upgrade from my own father, actually had this within him as well. And the conclusion that I've come away from it with is that our fathers may have both abused us, but that my father's motivations were extremely different. I don't think they could have been more disparate. I really do think Jerry loved Stephanie fiercely and was doing what he knew how to do. You know, he was a Ukrainian refugee who had been through so many trials and tribulations, and this is what he knew how to do. My father, I don't know why he was the way he was. You know, there was more of a sadism. It wasn't an attempt at parenting. So it was different in that way. And that's actually a distinction that I think it's important to make.
That's interesting. And also a way for you to resolve your better experience with Jerry Kupchinski. You know, I was interested to read in the early pages of the book, you address the issue of the disparate treatment of the disappearance of white middle-class women from black, brown, and indigenous women. First of all, talk a little bit about that, and why did you address that right up front?
I think I'm trying to be aware that I am contributing another narrative about a missing white woman, you know? And so I think I felt that it was important to address pretty soon on that I'm aware of the voice I'm adding to the chorus. And that she was my family member perhaps makes it different, but that there is a great disparity in the way that stories of missing Black women, missing Indigenous women are told, even in the way that they're portrayed in the media. You know, I can't remember the woman's name who I wrote about. I would have to find it in the book, but how when she was missing, the news put pictures of her holding a cell phone like a gun, like almost making her look like criminal, portraying her as criminal when she was actually a victim. As opposed to Stephanie, who was always portrayed as the girl next door, which is a trope that I tried to dismantle in my book as well. You know, I think it's important to note that injustice.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Rachel Rear about her memoir and investigation, Catch the Sparrow, A Search for a Sister and the Truth of Her Murder. It is quite a detailed investigation. I mean, I think you really brilliantly construct this book.
Thank you.
But you discovered early on, even though in fact you were, when you began this investigation, you were really helped by the police. But originally the police were not so eager to pursue the case of Stephanie's disappearance in the beginning. And even when one detective did start to pursue it with zeal, the investigation went nowhere. You say the corruption in the Greece Police Department was one reason. Tell our listeners about that.
Sure. I think that the initial response to Stephanie's disappearance was, well, it's hard to say if it's protocol or not. You know, she went missing on a Wednesday night. Friday night is when her boyfriend discovered she was missing. And it took until Monday for a missing persons report to be filled in, even though they were begging the whole entire weekend for the police to do something. The police were saying things like, you know, maybe she ran off with another guy. Maybe she just wanted to escape her life. There were a lot of possible explanations and people saying, no, that's not who she was. And especially because she left her birds behind and she would never do that. And people were just really insistent. And once Dave Connors took it up, he was very passionate about it and committed. But remember that it was a missing persons case for almost 7 years, not a homicide until her remains were found. The corruption in Greece is something that I had no idea about before I started my research. I just wanted to tell the story. I didn't know the direction my book would take when I started researching. Actually, one of my first nights in Rochester, I was sitting at the bar at this restaurant, and the bartender and I were just chatting, and it turned out that he was a lawyer. He had been a lawyer. And so he was familiar with a lot of the case. And he started talking to me about a lot of the corruption in the political and police world of Greece, New York. He said, oh my gosh, you don't know about all this stuff? And then we ended up having lunch another day so that he was like sort of a town historian. And once I started really digging at that, I actually went really down a rabbit hole with it. And it actually was somewhat of a distraction for a while and difficult to wade through, because I ended up going back to like the 1960s, basically, in Greece politics to try to figure out how all of these big fish in a small pond with these motivations of I don't even know, power, fame, notoriety. I don't know what it is that they were seeking.
Money.
Money. A lot of times it was political endorsements or political positions. A lot of it was connected to elections and party loyalty and things like that. But what it resulted in was a chief of police in the 90s, Merritt Ron, who ended up going to jail because he was involved in a whole bunch of fudged background checks. There were property issues, things going missing, like actual computers. And I forget what else. I might be inaccurate about this, but the property clerk's office had some issues. But whatever it was, it came to a head when there were two police officers, Nick Joseph, who crashed his car into the back of a pregnant woman's vehicle, causing her to go into premature labor while he was drunk and high on cocaine and speeding. And Gary Pignotto, who was found guilty of coercing a woman into having sex with him, a woman who was on probation, you know, sort of like making deals with them. And this just brought down the whole entire police department, and the chief ended up going to jail. And a lot of people that I spoke to said that including Todd Baxter, the chief of police who reopened or reassigned Stephanie's case and allowed
the new chief of police.
The new chief of police. He's no longer the chief of police, but the one who took over for Merritt Ron really had a lot to say about the toxic environment and the low morale of the police department. And all I could do is imagine the effect that would have. And Todd Baxter himself says, you know, maybe when you're working for a chief like that or in an environment like that, maybe you don't push yourself. Maybe you aren't creative. Maybe you're just doing what you have to do. And I understand this as a public school teacher who has experienced throughout my 22 years of teaching, different kinds of administrators and different kinds of environments. And it's true. You know, when the morale is low, people are not invested in things. So it was just a completely toxic environment. And that was the environment in which Stephanie's case was being worked on. So there's no way to say, you know, here is a person who, you know, prevented this piece of evidence, or, you know, there's not like a direct causation. But I just imagine the environment and have had so many, you know, I think Stan Chizik referred to Merritt Ron as an absentee landlord, for example.
You know, I think this is an important point, because one thing I've been thinking about a lot is how it is impossible to govern where there's corruption.
Yes.
And the more corrupt our political system is, the more we fail to deal with the incredible crises that we face: COVID, climate, the violence from the proliferation of guns. I mean, nothing can be dealt with because of the corruption.
100%, you know. I think it's like, you know, you're talking about a woman who was a victim of violence, and then you have police officers within the same police department who are committing violence against women. So what is the mindset of those police officers in that department? And how can they take a case serious? You know, it's just, when you start to think about it, it's infuriating, really. And I did start to think of Greece as a microcosm, a fishbowl. That was just an example of something that I'm sure it proliferates across the country. I think it may have been Todd Baxter, called Greece the most corrupt police department in America. And my response is kind of like, I doubt it, you know? It's just one. Yeah.
Exactly. It's just the one he knew about.
You know, so even in the minds and even in the minds of the people involved in the corruption and in the cleanup, subsequent cleanup of the corruption, there's a kind of self-mythologizing or mythologizing of what's going on. So just as for me, this is this is a self-mythologizing for me. It is for all of these other people as well. The same narrative, with all of its twists and turns and systemic failures, everyone's telling themselves their own story of it. So Todd Baxter says, this is the most corrupt police department in America. You know, because he's the center. For him, he's the protagonist in his own world, just like I am and you are. But I you know, when I think about it, I'm just like, no, I really just think Grease, New York is an example of what is super common.
Now, the detective on the case originally suspected her boyfriend, but the murderer turned out to be someone else. According to the killer, according to himself, he was the victim of horrific child abuse. So this is a guy guilty of multiple rapes and at least one murder, that of your stepsister. What were your thoughts as you learned about his history of abuse, in light of the many rapes that you knew he had committed? In other words, I'm asking, how do we balance our compassion for someone who's a victim with the terrific crimes that he commits as a perpetrator?
I usually try not to give away too much about the end of the book, but I have found ways to say, I spent a lot of time researching criminal psychopaths in my process of writing this book, speaking to Dean Haycock, who wrote a book called Murderous Minds about criminal psychopaths. And my conversation with Dean Haycock was heartbreaking. You know, I told him about the childhood of Stephanie's killer. And one of the last things he said to me on the phone was, no one should have a life like that. And he firmly believes that the prison system is not the correct place for psychopaths. And I think I might agree. I don't know what is. Again, is this another systemic failure of our society? Perhaps. So Sam Harris has a speech about free will where he says, if you traded places with a psychopath atom for atom, you would be him. And then he says, does that mean that we don't hold them accountable for their actions? No, of course not. They need to be removed from society because it's better for society. So yes, criminal psychopaths need to be removed from society because they will wreak havoc and they will sexually assault people and be violent and murder people. And society must reject that, you know. But I don't know that just putting them in a prison cell is the appropriate way to deal with them. So I actually, in a strange way, that was one of the most surprising experiences I had, was a level of compassion for psychopaths, because a lot of them did not have a choice to become what they are, or didn't have much choice. I don't know. You know, it's, of course, they should be held accountable. And it challenges my belief in free will, to be honest. You know, I have to sort of come to terms with how much of it is choice and how much of it isn't. But what I do know is that man had a childhood none of us, I mean, very few of us probably can imagine. You know, the horrors of his childhood greatly surpass anything that Stephanie or I experienced in our childhoods in terms of abuse and abandonment.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Rachel Rear about her book, Catch the Sparrow, A Search for a Sister and the Truth of Her Murder. Yeah, and another question is, I mean, this book is about your sister's murder, but it also casts the lens wider to take in the pandemic of violence against women that's overwhelmingly committed by men. Has your investigation changed how you feel about safety in the world and how you balance fear with trust?
It did not necessarily change how I felt. It may have reaffirmed how I felt, because now I have statistics to back up what I already sensed, you know. In terms of safety, one of the quotes that I refer to in the book is Helen Keller's quote, security is an illusion. No, what is she? I don't remember exactly what word for word what her quote is, but that's the essence of it, that security is an illusion, that avoiding danger is no safer in the long run than exposure. Which is actually a quote I used to have on a t-shirt when I was like 14 or 15. So it's so strange that this concept has sort of been swimming around in my mind basically my whole life, the idea that safety is illusory. But I actually think that can be liberating in a way, because once you recognize that safety and security are illusory, you can liberate yourself from seeking them. You know, you can say, I can only do so much. And then you're not to blame if something happens to you. I write in the book about my own sexual assault as well. You know, there was nothing I could do to avoid that happening. I mean, maybe, I don't know, you know, but that's the way it happened. And I can't blame myself for it. I can only take whatever precautions I think are reasonable. I can put a deadbolt on my door. I can, you know, close the grate on my fire escape window, but that's not going to stop a mass shooter on the subway, which is what happened today in Brooklyn, which was perpetrated by a man, because men are overwhelmingly the perpetrators of violence against women and men. It didn't necessarily change anything I felt, because I already knew how much sexual assault there is, knowing how many of my friends have been sexually assaulted. So I guess what it did was transform anecdotal evidence into hard data once I started researching. So just, yeah, reaffirmed what I already knew. And my takeaway at the end of the book, I don't think it's too much to say, but is, you know, I actually hope that the last chapter of my book is uplifting, because once I really went into the trenches and did all this thinking and did all this work, my takeaway really, and this happened actually, this strange event happened the first day of my research, when I went to meet with Sandra Dorley, the DA of Monroe County. It had been raining for days. And when I left her office, the sun had come out. And this was sort of like very strange buzz had come over me, because I really had learned the details of Stephanie's murder that day. Sandra Dorley just told me the whole story, really. Even though I never said like, hey, can you tell me all the details? It was like she was like trying to get rid of them, the burden of these details, you know, that only a few people had known until that moment. And when I stepped outside, I just kept thinking to feel joy. And I just, you know, all these beautiful images were flashing through my mind that I write about in the book. And I really do think that at the moment that you liberate yourself from an attachment to security, you can focus on lightheartedness and joy. You know, Alan Watts's first book is called The Wisdom of Insecurity. And I really do think that that's a concept I try to keep in my mind most of the time.
I have it on the shelf right in front of my eyes. There's one other thing I'd like to ask you. There were several moments in the book where you felt Stephanie's spirit, some would say ghost, in the room. Could you talk a little bit about that? And also, did other people also experience something like this?
I mean, I am a skeptic by nature, so I don't necessarily know that I 100% believe in these things. They're the sort of things that, you know, there's no explanation for. Or what? One time my therapist said to me, oh, what, you think you understand the whole universe because you have a cortex? And I'm like, well, okay, fine. Maybe there are things I don't understand, you know, and I can't explain and I can't logic my way through. But, you know, so I take the experiences as they are. I can't, you know, I can't help what I sense. So yeah, there was one night when I was 21, which was, this happened maybe 2 months after her remains were found. And I was home and everybody else was asleep and I was washing dishes downstairs. And I just felt this sort of glowy, burny presence behind me and to the right, almost like it was just kind of observing me. And I was like, I bet it's Stephanie. I'm just going to slowly go upstairs. It's unsettling. It's an unsettling feeling. I'm just going to go upstairs, you know, and as soon as I got upstairs, it went away, the feeling. And then I asked my mom, hey, has Stephanie been around the house lately? Because this is something that we share, this sort of sensing when other relatives, like when I was younger, my great aunt, we would both kind of sense her around the house, usually around like Jewish holidays. It was interesting.
I said, has Stephanie been around the house? And she said, oh yeah, yeah, she's been around all the time. And she was all over the place. And then one day I was vacuuming in my bedroom and Stephanie was in there. And I said out loud to her, Stephanie, I understand you want to be with your dad, but this is my house too. And so you can't come upstairs. And she said she just hasn't been upstairs since then. And I didn't tell my mom that when I got upstairs, the feeling went away. She offered that information. So it was one of those sort of eerie things, you know, like Stephanie was respecting my mom's wishes to stay downstairs. I don't know, you know. And then the other time was, this was actually amazing. My other stepsister, Melanie, and my mom and I were sitting around my stepfather, Jerry's deathbed. He really held on for days past the hospice nurse's prediction. And we were listening to some classical music, and there was this suddenly very swirly, warm energy, almost like a glowing. I almost feel like in my memory, like the color of the light changed in the room or something, but we all felt it. Nobody said anything. Right. It felt to me like Stephanie was there and that she was almost excited, you know, like anticipating her father, you know. And after a while, it sort of settled down. And I said to Melanie and my mom, it's so weird. I just felt like Stephanie was here and she was like all excited to be with her dad again. And Melanie said, that's so strange. I felt that my former conductor, George Schulte, was here whispering in my ear, Coraggio. And then my mom said, that's so weird. I felt like my first husband, Nino, was here standing behind me. So we all had this strange sense right at the exact same time. So I don't know how you could possibly explain that, you know, using just your cortex, but it happened and it was quite beautiful.
Well, that's a wonderful story. Well, Rachel Rear, this is just a fascinating book. Catch the Sparrow, A Search for a Sister and the Truth of Her Murder. You do a terrific job with the investigation and the writing. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me. This is really philosophically interesting and fun to talk about.
Rachel Rear is a writer, actor, and teacher in New York City. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.